Hello, and welcome to High and Low, a Kurosawa podcast. I'm your host, Spencer, and with me is a rambunctious old man. He wants to escape the hospital, but we keep catching him every time.
He wants to escape the hospital, but his boner is too big. Right? That's what happened in this movie.
Yeah.
Not to be too foul right out the bat, but this guy's got... He's got one track mind, and that includes doing things with ladies and dying. Hello, my name is Joel Torres. Let's talk about this hilarious comedy about a man dying of cancer.
Yes, this is a second half of the 1993 pairing. This first one was Mata Dayo. Now this episode is Juzo Itami's a movie, The Last Dance, and we covered another Juzo Itami movie before that was A Taxing Woman, and he did Tampopo, which will be with Martin Kessler in late October, I think, or early November. I can't remember which. So yeah, we're gonna cover some more of him. I would recommend this. Like, I really like Itami's weird sensibility of like comedy and like serious stuff.
Sure, yeah. I also think it's fine. It was definitely worth watching, and I get a even more sense of his particular style. But you should know going into it, if you have certain triggers like dying of cancer, that you should be careful about that, you know. So here's this story right out the bat that I told Spencer I was going to say. I was over at my parents' house. Sometimes I just take my laundry out there because it's easier than going to get the $10 in quarters and sitting at a machine. Plus, it gives me time to visit. And we sit down and do you have a movie you need to watch? Sometimes mom will just ask me, and I was like, oh yeah, I've got this movie called The Last Dance. And it's like, okay, let's put on. I didn't look in to see what this was about or anything like that. I knew it was by the director of A Taxi Woman, so I thought it would be silly.
It is silly in parts.
Oh, absolutely. No. It's got comedic beats. It's got that same kind of jazzy score going on and stuff like that. Actors in common. Obviously, the main lady from A Taxing Woman plays the director's wife, right?
And Tommy's wife in real life.
Mm-hmm. And the doctor is the bad guy, in A Taxing Woman?
He was like the inspector chief.
Okay, I thought he was the...
The bad guy... I think he shows up, but I'm not sure where.
Yeah. I don't remember, but I remembered him being in the other movie. Anyways, we sit down, we watch, and this movie opens with some soft music, you know, sad thing going on here. It's like, oh, okay. And there's a man who's choking. He's practically choking, coughing so hard, lying in bed. And we hear a woman singing in Japanese. Is the song Save the Last Dance for Me?
Yes.
And, as soon as you hear it, if you know that song, you know exactly what she's singing. She's singing the lyrics in Japanese. And we see that he's in a hospital bed. And, you know, he's hooked up to all the wires and all the stuff like that. Or it's not a hospital bed in this case, but he's in a sick bed. And she's like, oh, you know, I'll be with you and take care of you if you're okay. And then she looks and, you know, like, obviously this man is cancer and he's dying of cancer. And at this point, I'm looking over at my mom and going, oh, this is probably a mistake. This is probably a mistake. Why would that be a mistake, Joel, you might ask? Well, my mother is a cancer survivor.
Oh.
She had a double mastectomy and she's been cancer free for more than 5 years, I think, at this point. But I was living at the house when she was going through that, and it's not something I like to remember. Not something that is a good thing for someone to recall. So we stick it out And, you know, this woman's singing to her husband, who is obviously very sick, and she looks at him and she says, "By the way, the doctor called, and it turns out I have cancer too, so I won't be able to take care of you for much longer." And oh my God, oh my God. I was like, what movie did I walk into here? And, you know, they're sad together, and she starts singing again, and he starts coughing. It's like, I don't know if this was a good idea. And then somebody says cut off screen. It turns out they're recording. They're making a film, like a sad cancer drama movie within the movie. But it is a movie about a man dying of cancer. In this case, the director, who is also the lead actor in this movie they're making. So yeah, we got to... I think right before he had to go in to get his first surgery.
Mm-hmm.
So like after he was throwing up in the toilet or whatever. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to watch the rest at home.
Well, yeah, that sounds like a good choice. I'm glad your mom is cancer free, but yeah, I can imagine that being a weird situation.
Yeah, I mean, that's just something that could happen when you go blind into movies, I guess, right?
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's an odd choice to make a movie about a man dying of cancer with music that goes, da-dun, 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 da-dun.
Yeah.
Like, oh, running around Three Stooges style. Oh, am I going to get caught? And by the way, a lady? Oh, boner. And then he dies.
Yeah.
Spoiler.
It's weird because, like the tones that Tommy's working with should not work well together, yet they work well together. Like,
yeah.
Like, the music is in the first hour. It's about 2 hours, and the music in the first hour is a super upbeat, like, jazzy, dancey, like a Caribbean cruise type music that you hear like almost constantly for like the first about 10 minutes or so. And then once like an hour in, it's more an hour and it gets a bit more serious because there's a scene with a man who's like, I think it's when you meet the Phlegm guy, it's about when the super happy music stops playing. And you don't hear it again for the rest of the movie, but for our first hour, you keep hearing this reframe of this really upbeat, happy music as things get darker and darker.
Mm-hmm.
And it has, like, the Tommy scenes of just, like montage-style close-up shots of... I think you get some food stuff, because he apparently likes to do, like, montages of food in a lot of movies. Mm-hmm. And you get, like, this... his weird quirky sense of humor, and yeah, I don't know,
I was just gonna say, it feels like somebody challenged him to make I want you to make a movie about a man dying of cancer and then find some way to make it funny. It's like, well, what if we inserted like Benny Hill into it or something like that, you know, like, I don't know. It's the stereotype of the lusty Japanese old man. That's the thing. It's like, what if he was dying?
Yeah. Like, and yet,
like, okay, you're the director. I guess you can do what you want.
Yeah, it's weirdly meta, like within the film, because all the things that happen within the movie he's making, he decides to do, and it's. I have written in my notes somewhere that's similar to I can't remember. It's like there's some movie I was thinking of where like dreams and reality. Oh, Perfect Blue, which I just saw, kind of reminds me of that a little bit, where like the fiction of the world and the reality of the world merge, but in this it's more not purposeful, but it's more like he's doing. The characters are aware of what's are aware of it, and are
it's not a psychedelic side trip. It's like that both the realities exist at the same time, right? We're not talking about like a dreamscape, like merge. It's not trying to trick the viewer.
Oh, no. It's never any point trying to like bullshit you into being like, oh, maybe he's imagining all of it. It's like you know it's happening. It's just he happened to be making a movie about a man dying of cancer, and then he's dying of cancer, and like the whole Save the Last Dance angle of her, of the wife in the movie singing that his wife in the reality of in the movie, like that's how he first met her. She was singing that at a club, and you know, and it gets a little like things like that get repeated from the movie where it's pretty interesting.
I'm just going to go cry now. No, wait, what?
Okay. Now, there's not a very strong plot, like a Texan woman. It's more episodic of those random points.
Yeah, I mean, it starts at day 365, so we're actually seeing, like, the last year of this guy's life done through, you know, his perspective mostly. Occasionally, we get his wife and doctor's perspective because she's also dealing with what's going on, and they collectively decide they're going to keep secret from him and almost until the end of his time that he actually has cancer. You know, and up until then they've been telling him he's just got really bad ulcers. You know, they had to do major surgery to remove these ulcers.
Yeah, he has to soldier on.
Yep, and he hates that. He hates people telling him to soldier on.
Yeah. This was a little bit, like your thing with your, this kind of reminded me of my grandma died from cancer this year, and mm-hmm. some of this hit a little too hard, a little too soon.
Yeah, I mean, it's effective that way.
Yeah, like, I found this to be incredibly moving. It didn't make me cry, but there are several points where it was pretty close.
It's not inauthentic about, like, what people would go through in the, like, actual dying situation here in the, you know, dying of cancer over this time period. But I'll tell you what, if we were supposed to gain sympathy for this character after spending, you know, a movie time-wise year with him, like, at the end, he's surrounded by these people that absolutely love him and are at his deathbed. And like, I understand that he had a good relationship with, like, all the people he worked with and stuff like that. But I think, like, they show him to be a pretty rotten-to-the-core person when it comes to his wife, and that's not very cool.
Yeah, he's definitely a flawed person who... I didn't feel some... I wouldn't say I didn't feel sympathy for him, but I didn't necessarily forgive him for the way he treated his wife, because you see, he's just he likes to have affairs and have mistresses, and he likes to, you know, if a woman's attractive, why not? Who cares? Marriage doesn't matter. But at the same time, it's like he's also dying, so it's kind of thing of like, it'd be weird to automatically hate him given what he's going through.
Yeah, I mean, I don't hate him or anything like that. I just don't think he's the most sympathetic character, which I guess is the point. I mean, people of all stations of life and all stations of wealth and all stations of good versus bad person, be a better side even.
Cause it basically boils down to he's making a movie. I don't think you ever know the name of the movie. I don't remember. You said he's making a movie about a man dying of cancer, then he has symptoms of some sort of stomach cancer, intestinal cancer, and he's cheating on his wife with the lead actress, and they seem to have I got the feeling they have a history together.
Yeah.
And the wife is very upset, and she's going to leave him, but then realizes he needs to go to hospital, and it's him in the hospital for about, I'd say 90 minutes or so. Like for the first half hour or so, it's just him kind of ignoring the symptoms of what's happening to him.
Well, he goes and he has that surgery done. And they actually let him out of the hospital at first, because he goes and shoots another scene of the movie wherein we see his the actress who's playing his wife. She plays the part of it's getting meta here. His wife in the movie that they're making dies of cancer before his character does.
Yeah.
And we watch that happen, because she doesn't just die. She decides to kill herself, which is another trigger, by the way. If you're triggered by suicide,
yep,
this is another thing that happens in this movie more than once.
Yeah, and she does it in a violent way where she puts a plastic bag over her head and just, you know.
Oh, by the way, that reminded me of another trigger.
What?
So, somebody I know had a sibling who died very, very suddenly of cancer. He didn't realize that something was wrong with him, and then one day he went in the hospital, and they thought maybe he had a blood clot, but it turned out he had cancer running up part of his body, and they had to amputate part of him.
Oh.
And that was not enough. It was already so far gone that he died about a week after he went in the hospital. And the story that person told me was that as he was dying, his mother was singing to him. And I remember hearing that. This was more than a decade ago that this person told me this. And I looked at them and I said, that is the most horrifying story I've ever told. I know it's it should be comforting, kind of. It's mm-hmm. Mother singing as her son dies. But just imagining that, I was like, I think I'm going to throw up. And something similar to that happens in this movie.
Yeah.
So this is a very personal episode.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Let's see. He gets a surgery done, and they think it's gone, but it isn't. And they decide to keep him in hospital to monitor the ulcers, but it's not ulcers. Everyone knows it's cancer except for him, and there's a doctor, Dr. Agata, who is the boss from Taxing Woman. Kind of looks like Nakadai a little bit, like he could be his cousin.
Yeah.
There's a nurse who I think it might be in Taxing Woman, but I'm not positive.
She seems like a team player, not team player, but a company player, the kind of people that he would have in most of his movies.
Yeah, the mistress, I think, was an Taxing Woman.
Probably.
I think she played one of the girlfriends of the bad guy in that, but I'm not sure. Because I feel like she wore tiger print in that also. Or leopard print or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. There was one girl that was going to talk to the leading tax lady, mm-hmm. and then she changed her mind or something else happened. I gotta rewatch it.
Yeah, that's a great.
That's a fun movie.
Yeah, that's a really fun, funny movie. This is funny, but not necessarily fun.
I mean, it's a roller coaster. The thing about it is it's not going crazy in tone, even though we're kind of describing it way. Yeah. It plays with the tone in such a way that the serious parts do feel serious, but the silly parts are just this is what the director wants to do, and the actors are fully committed to it. It's like, I don't know, the characters in silly moments feel like the same characters in the serious moments. So it accomplishes that tonal shift pretty damn well, if you ask me.
It's very organic, their shifts, and from this is a funny scene, this is a sad scene, this is a a bittersweet scene. Like Itami just has, in A Taxi Woman too, he managed to mix like serious and silly in such a brilliant way that I feel like if anyone else attempted like to adapt his script, it wouldn't work.
Yeah, it would be incredibly difficult.
And the director is the nurse. In the credits on IMDb, her name is not listed, the nurse's character, but in the movie, the doctor calls her Hayashi at one point. And the doctor got a nurse, Hayashi. The wife is Moriko. Mariko. And that's she starred in A Taxi Woman. She's the real life wife of Juzo Itami. Yeah. They were married for, well, he was, didn't they get married in like 69 or 70? And then Itami was found dead and expectulated. Maybe Yakuza did it, maybe not. It's still kind of up in the air.
Is this the director? The director was found dead?
He was murdered in 1997. Oh, well, found dead. And no one knows who did it still. And the director in the movie, Buhai, he thought a regular player with Itami, from what
I saw. I figured.
But
he was the standout.
Yeah, but he's in the MMR movie, Vengeance Is Mine, which was about a serial killer, which was supposed to be one of his best movies. And, yeah, that's kind of like his other main thing, is that MMR movie that's supposed to be pretty dark and fucked up. But it's MMR, so you know it's going to be dark and fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
And tomorrow, as of this recording, is Shohei Imamura's birthday. But that's besides the point. So yeah, I just want to get those characters, the nurse, doctor, wife, and Buhai. And I guess maybe the mistress, but she doesn't really play that big of a part, really.
Yeah, I mean, she's only important as that, like I said, I think that plays to his character. It's like they have kind of a loving relationship, although at the last time they see each other, he basically is like, this is probably going to be the last time we see each other, because, you know, he's like indicating that he's going to die. And she's like, okay. And she like starts to leave, and she turns around and like waves to him like, bye. He's like, okay, bye. So they like, even though it's apparent that they've had a relationship for a while, they don't have the like weepy, like, I'm going to miss you kind of one that he has with his wife, you know.
Yeah.
True affection, love, or whatever.
Yeah. So
she's important to the plot because she's the only one he bones. Just kidding. That's not true. I mean, it is true. That is the only one, but that's not why she's important.
Yeah. She's significant, but doesn't have much screen time. But, right. Wait, so to test, the doctor and the wife knew each other in college, which you would think would lead to something more, but not really. Well, I guess maybe they're trusting each other, maybe. But that's it from what I can tell.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, maybe the relationship will work out into something where, you know, more later. But right now, while he's dying, she's kind of unable to see anybody else. You know, even to the point where, like, she basically directly catches him cheating and runs off. But, you know, something happens where she has to run back, you know, into a...
Yeah. After the surgery, he he's staying at the hospital for a bit. They decorate his room in red, and a whole bunch of red stuff. And he meets a guy who is also dying of cancer, who it was in the same situation as him, and just that's when he realizes, oh, they've been lying to me this entire time.
Yep.
And he says, like, mentions, like, the purple IV, like, it's this haunting, horrible thing, and then you, I think you get an insert shot of the purple IV, which is a chemo thing, which is...
Well, it's the very next, like, after that conversation, where they also see Phlegm Guy.
Yeah.
Who is suffering and can't even move, but he's constantly having his phlegm collected. And that's like basically his horrible existence. They won't let him die, though, because that's not what you do, I guess. But
yeah,
after the purple bottle thing, he like goes back to his hospital bed. And they're like, okay, it's time for your IV. And it's the purple bottle for the first time. He's like, ah!
Yeah, it's like a weird horror movie moment. There are some bizarre kind of horror moments sprinkled throughout. And yeah. From there, it's... I'm trying to think of another major event after that. I think shortly after that is when they... Is he trying to get back on the set after this point?
No, I don't think so. Like, I mean, he's trying to get out all the time, you know, would he... There's a point where he... I think the next major event that happens is, like, he starts losing his hair, so he's wearing this, like, hat. And his friend, who... I don't know what that guy's name is, like, the producer. He's got these, like, white tufts of hair on the side of his head. Yeah, he's... That guy's there, and he's like, I need you to do me a favor. And he's like, I want you to bring my mistress over to the hospital. Like, okay. So he does. He gets the mistress to go up to the room, and the producer's downstairs with the director's wife, like, distracting him by, like, having lunch together or whatever. And so they have sex, director and his mistress.
Oh, and he fully pleases her this time.
Because
the first time you see him have sex, he's like, sorry, I'm an old man. And this time she, you know, enjoys it fully.
Yeah. And they're mid doing it, but suddenly two nurses walk in, because obviously this wouldn't be happening. And they're like, oh, you're disgusting. I can't believe you. You know, you need to get out of here, young lady. So... speaking of young lady, I think this actress, I think that his mistress is like the same age as his wife. She's not like younger.
No.
Because she's like complaining about like, oh, I'm getting older. My hair's falling out.
Yeah. And then there's this comedic scene of him picking up all her stray hairs.
Yeah. The actor miming that he's picking up individual hairs.
Because his wife will notice. But then, yeah, right. They have sex and she leaves. And the wife. Notices her leaving, and she shows up again and is like, well, I'm never going to see you again because you're a terrible person. And shortly after that, I think around that time, the doctor and nurse have a big blow up.
Yeah. And the doctor goes into the room with another IV ready to go, the purple stuff. Not Sunny D.
Nope.
And he gets really angry, like, why won't anyone tell me the truth? Why won't you? You need to let me go. And the director takes the purple stuff and smashes over the doctor's head. And you think he's going to seize an opportunity to get out of here at this point, because the doctor's on the floor. He's kind of knocked out. You see, before he leaves the room, he grabs a plastic bag. Like, okay, whatever. And he starts running down the hallway. Like, there's nurses out there. You don't see a patient running down a hallway and go like, hey, what the hell's going on?
Yeah, and he's like, kind of covering up. So it's like, you know, so there's no, because like his scrubs or whatever, not scrubs, but like the hospital gown, you know, there's some dirt and stuff on it. So he covers up so it doesn't look suspicious.
Yeah. And we don't really see where he goes, but The doctor wakes up and realizes this guy's gone, and he's got a big gash on his forehead. He goes over to the nurse's station. And he's like, the patient has run off, and the nurses can't hear because they're freaking out. Oh my God, you got blood all over your head. You know, right.
Yeah.
And so they try to fix, you know, they're too busy fixing him when he's finally like, well, where the hell did he go? Like, I thought they saw him going onto the roof. Like, oh, crap. So everybody, the doctor and all the nurses, all start running up the stairs or the elevator or whatever to get to the roof. And by the time they get up there, our director friend has put the plastic bag around his head and is trying to kill himself.
Yeah. Is this when he separates into, like, the spirit world?
Yeah, that's when we get kind of a psychedelic cool thing going on here.
Yeah, like, some of the CGI, that looks not great.
Yeah. No, some fun 1993 green screen shit.
Yeah, but still, you know, it's still pretty cool to see, like...
It reminded me of Dreams.
Oh, yeah, I got honestly, that, too.
I mean, not as high a budget, obviously, for whatever effects they were doing. Well, for Dreams,
Kurosawa got his buddy Lucas to help him out.
Oh, yeah. It's the least he could do. And, yeah, so the doctors and the nurses are taking him down there, and we actually see him as kind of a ghost separated from his body, following his body along.
And, like, this was bothering me a whole lot. The CPR in this movie is terrible movie CPR. I am trained in CPR. My license ran out this year, but I was licensed for 2 years. And I can tell you with CPR, your arms are supposed to be stiff, not bent. In all CPR in this movie, their arms are bent, and if you're doing that, well, you're not going to save anyone's life.
Spencer, you're not a doctor. This guy is a doctor, okay? I think he knows how to do CPR.
Okay, whatever you say. It that drives me crazy knowing the correct way of doing so many movies get it wrong.
So yeah, that's a trigger for you.
Yeah, although the show Scrubs got it right.
They better. Getting all that comedy money.
Yeah, but also the doctor, he's like trying to do CPR on Buhai as they're rushing him through the hallways, and it's it looks ridiculous, but it's like genuinely like thrilling, not thrilling, but like harrowing. Like you wonder how they're gonna get out of this situation.
Yeah, because we've been seeing, like, the days progressively get less, you know, 365 down to, you know, half that time to 90 days and stuff like that. So we know we're not at the end of his life, but, like, I don't know, is he going to end up in a coma or something like that? It's kind of...
You see Phlegm Guy, so it's like, maybe that's a foreshadowing, who knows?
Yeah, exactly. But... And there's a... Like we said, his wife has actually told him, like, I'm never going to see you again, you know, die alone. Bastard. And she arrives home back to their house. They've got two pianos at their house. That's a nice touch.
Yeah. And she was a piano club singer thing.
Right. And they probably like play together, sing together and stuff like that. They have that in common. Yeah.
And she sees his ghost.
Yep. He's standing there at the piano and she's like, what are you doing? How did you even get here? And he holds out this heart-shaped box to her. And then he fades away. And she knows, oh, crap, he's dying. Which, yeah, I could get that. Like, I assume if I saw somebody that was in the hospital, like in a vision, I'd probably be freaked out, too.
Yeah.
She manages to get back to the hospital in record time and is in there while they're trying to resuscitate him.
Yeah.
And there is a funny shot where he's... It's like a shot from Doctor Strange. He's like floating above his body, and the camera's done in such a way where you can't see his feet sometimes, and sometimes you can't see like the middle of his body. It's like, you know, the trick shot, so you can't see where he's being held up.
Yeah, and there's like this red tether connecting his spirit to his body.
Yeah. And then he goes off to the moon.
Yeah, he goes to, like, the spirit world and sees his ancestors, and he's gonna cross over, but then this ghost of a little girl who, family member, spirit of death, who knows, I'm not entirely sure, but she...
I feel like there is a Japanese...
Yokai or something?
Like, something going on there, like a cultural thing that we just don't, we're not familiar with.
Yeah, I also got that, with that too, with like, yeah, what you're saying, like, it's probably some specific cultural thing that Americans would have no idea what it's what it is. Kind of like the other 1993 movie we covered. So the spirit, I don't think there's any speaking in the spirit world either. It's just like him wandering around, and then the ghost girl just like puts her hand up, and then he gets to live a little bit longer.
Well, he falls off a cliff. But yeah. And in the hospital room there, you know, they're doing the defibrillator. Defibrillator? What is it called?
Yeah, right.
Okay. And his wife's like, no, do it, try it one more time. He's like, oh, but if I turn it up this high, it'll definitely kill him if he wasn't already dead. Like, one more time. So they do it one more time, and that's what takes him. And the doctor's like, you saved him with the power of love. Like, also, it was probably that last defibrillator thing. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Just goes to show you, never give up.
Does this count as a fantasy movie?
Yes.
So you could cover this on your podcast.
I mean, I don't... I mean, technically, I guess we could. Like, I don't know.
Okay.
Like, I guess I would have to talk it over with the goof troop.
Yeah.
To see what they say. Chances are they would be like, yeah, of course. It'd be... I'm the one who's the stickler.
It'd be a little more serious, that episode.
Yeah.
But, there they go from that. He's saved. And, where is it? Oh, I put my notes, Ogata is redeemed. And I think that's after that, they kind of make up. Because they've been at each other's throats basically this whole time. And then they kind of, decide to... They have at least an understanding at this point.
Right, he becomes much calmer. Like, he has a better relationship with the doctor. There's a scene where they share a drink with each other, and he's like, he finally gets the doctor to admit to him that he has cancer, that he's dying of this, which is funny. Like he tried to kill himself. I think you could just level with him at that point. Yeah. But he's got like 30 days left at that point when he finally admits it to him.
Yeah, and before that, the doctor is with the wife. And it's this brilliant scene of tension of their talking around, like, how much time he has. And you just see the ash on their cigarettes just get longer. Looks like in The Shining, there's a shot of Shelley smoking. And, we're friends. I call her Shelley.
I know who you're talking about. Your girlfriend, Shelley.
Yeah, the other woman. But, the ash on her cigarette is just ridiculously long. It's like half the cigarette and you're shining, but in this, it's long enough where it's like, Jesus Christ, just put that out. That's bothering me.
And there's a lot of smoking in this movie.
It's Japan. They love smoking.
Oh, okay.
I knew some Japanese exchange students in college, and all of them were smokers.
That sucks.
It's a cultural thing, I guess. I don't know. It's more acceptable there, but kind of gross. But
yeah,
let's see, the tension thing, making the drink, and I think at that point in the talk you just hear it's silent except for a clock in the background, and so you just get this constant ticking as he explains, well, your time is running out. Which is a very easy thing. It's a very simple trick, but it's very effective.
Yeah. we're done with comedy at this point. Like, there's no more of that lightheartedness, no more of that saxophone music going on, I think.
Oh, no.
I was wrong. It's not 30 days. It's like 90 days, because I remember the conversation is, he tells the wife straight out that, like, he has about 3 months.
Yeah, and he tells him maybe 3 to 6 months. Yeah.
It could be like 1 year, 2 years, and he's like, yeah, but what's the worst case scenario? 6 months, 3 months, and the guy attaches immediately. He's like, so I have like 3 months. He's like, oh, no, not necessarily. He keeps talking about all these other things we can do, but with the wife, he's just like, there's nothing we can do.
Yeah, and like you and the audience, we saw 90, so we know for a fact it's 3 months. So like the countdown adds to like the effectiveness of the movie.
Now this is the part where it gets kind of rough, because it's like during this conversation he's like, I think I want to go home. Like, I don't want to keep doing treatments. I'd rather, you know, go finish my movie and, you know, die at my own pace. And the doctor's like, I'll think about it. And there's 30 days left. Like, wait, you had to sit around for 60 days before they were like, okay, you can leave the hospital now.
Yeah, the whole going home.
And then even, and then it's like another 2 weeks.
Yeah, but the whole thing of, well, I guess you clear it with like the whole bureaucracy.
Right, yeah, we don't see any of that stuff.
No, it's not a taxing one. We don't see the bureaucratical side of things, but yeah, the whole like stopping treatment that hit too close to home, and like going stopping treatment just being your own home was like, I just went through that this year, so that was a little too soon for me.
Yeah, well, now it's serious. Now everything's serious.
Yeah, and the nurse she has an idea for morphine. And the doctor, you know, initially was like, no, that's too strong. You're just a nurse.
Yeah, that's a silly part in the beginning, because he's like, I've been reading a lot about morphine tech, you know, and like for pain management and stuff like that. And he's like, he'll become an addict. Like, you know, he's going to die. Like, you already know how bad it is. It's like, oh, no, we can't do that to him. And then, like, by the end of the conversation, he's kind of like, I would like to read those things. And, you know, the nurse is excited about that. But it's like, not until the last 2 weeks of your life. Oh, here's a morphine cocktail for you.
Yeah, and she stands her ground. And, like, that's all way before this. But, like, she, you know, like, he says, you're just a nurse. And then she blows, like, this so blows
how
up.
How dare you speak to me that way?
Yeah, and it's like, well, you spend 30 seconds with a patient. We spend the entire day with a patient. You don't understand.
And she's right.
Yeah, and he's like, well, I want to see those books. And, yeah, he gets to finish his last, the finale scene to his film.
Yeah, one of his requests is that he gets to do the last scene, which is where he conducts this orchestra that he told his wife he was going to do this, and that's his character in the movie, I believe, is a conductor.
I guess he's supposed to be.
Yeah, so they do a whole full setup thing, and there's there's a full orchestra, and there's monks that are chanting, and it's actually really interesting. Like, seeing once again, I'm seeing a piece of culture that I've never seen before, where it's like, I've seen monks chanting, obviously. I've seen orchestras playing. I've never seen an orchestra accompany a monk, you know, chanting.
Yeah, it's,
I don't want to say ritual, but that's the only word that popped into mind.
It felt a specifically Buddhist thing.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's a powerful sequence, and it's mesmerizing, and you just get this droning like chant with like the orchestra, and it's dark, and like thematically it's like dark and about dying, and it's like, it's just this really impressive sequence at the end, and you get the titles and the title, but like you get the it's like a sing-along where you get the Japanese and you get the English. And it's just it just makes it seem even more imposing.
Yeah, and you see the audience knows these words as well. You've seen all these audience members singing along with the Buddhist chant, and that's like fascinating to me. He is like conducting, like swinging his arms around in a wheelchair this whole time, and finally at the end of the song, he just like collapses in his wheelchair. And it was nice of him to let the doctor and the nurse be part of the movie.
Yeah. And then he just says, cut, very weakly. And it's then... like,
did we get it?
Yeah. I listened to the podcast Wrong Reel, and the host, James Hancock, he worked on some indie horror stuff in the early 2000s in L.A., and there's a stuntman who basically ripped open his leg doing a stunt. He got rushed to the hospital, mm-hmm. and when they got to the hospital and he got operated on, he said to the director and crew, did we get it?
Yep. Have you ever seen any of the Jackass movies?
Of course.
I like that one where, I don't remember which one, is fighting Butterbean in that like convenience store.
Yeah, I think that's the first one.
Yeah, and like Butterbean hits him so hard, like just a couple of times, but knocks him out, and he's like snoring. He like wakes him up. He's like, "Is Butterbean okay?" Like, you bastard.
Yeah. So back to Last Dance, and then he kind of spends the rest of the movie in his home, and it's the last day.
Yeah, he's got this beautiful, like, end-of-life part where he's like, I've never really noticed how beautiful nature was, but, you know, like, he's, like, enlightening everybody else, and I can't help but feel it's kind of unearned, because I don't like this guy. Mm. Like, I know he's dying, and like, it's sad, but he's like, look at how beautiful everything is. And even at the end, like after that scene when he's like literally on his deathbed, he like sees his mistress and he like kind of smiles at her like, oh, you love me after all. Like, God, you're dying, man. Come on.
Yeah.
But yeah.
He is who he is.
That's basically it. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the whole thing of the nurse and doctor talk about something on a walk, and the wife puts on the toy rings because when they first met, he was too poor to afford a real ring, so he bought her a bunch of toy rings. And she mm-hmm. puts on the green and the white one, which goes into something I noticed in the movie, which is there are four prominent colors that you see throughout the whole thing. You see red, green, white, and purple. Which I'm not sure if you noticed, but those colors really stick out and you see repeated throughout the whole thing.
Yep.
And the purple, I think, is like a sign of bad, because it's the chemo, which he, you know, doesn't want to do. And then he busts the chemo thing on the doctor, and the scene where his wife says, I'm going to leave you in the beginning before he goes to the hospital. She's wearing purple there. So I think, and then red, I'm not sure, because red like is a color of blood, and there, and like the doctor, you know, he gets a bloody spot on his head, but then red is like his favorite color.
Yeah. I feel like that's like the manifestation of his passion for life and the things that are important to him. You know, the flowers are all bright red, the Buddha even painted red, and his whole, like, that crew family that knows this artist, this hardworking artist, that's how they know him as, you know, they know this is the man with that passion that loves the color red, so they bring him all this stuff.
Yeah. And white was the hospital, which I'm not sure what it's supposed to symbolize. I can't really think of, like, figure out a correlation with white. But white and green, in the hospital, there's that room that was just green, where he first met the guy who, like, the guy who's also dying of cancer. I think it's lung cancer, because when he first meets, he's like, oh, can you smoke that cigarette next to me? I want to smell it.
Yeah, he's doing that thing. Like, blow that smoke directly in my face. Rah!
Yeah, and he throws coffee like, oh, that's great. Which is like, which kind of made me sad because, like, oh man, that's not good for you.
So, like that lady in Stray Dog I was talking about. That's like, she looks like she's trying to drink the cigarette smoke when she finally gets her cigarette from,
yeah.
Takashi Moore or whatever his name is.
Yeah, the director, Buhai. So you never, did you feel sympathy for him at any point?
I actually got in trouble with people on the internet recently because, I was like, somebody, notorious in a bad way died of cancer. And I was like, I feel bad for the family members and, you know, the people who loved him. I don't feel bad for him. And like people, you know, obviously like got mad because, cancer is a bad thing. Like, I agree, but that does not absolve anybody of their sins. That's not to make me, it's not that I don't feel sympathy for him. It's that, I don't think like, oh my God, what a loss. Oh no. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I don't think that was necessarily her point though. Cause
no, of course not.
He's not supposed to be a forgivable person. He's just a horny old dude who, you know, he likes making movies because that's his.
Right, he's an artist. An
artist slash he gets to sleep around on his wife too.
Yep.
So like he's never absolved of anything. He's the same person he is, but he has this weirdly, you know, not weirdly, but he is this charismatic, you know, figure that people love and like the crew. Clearly loves him. Like there was a girl who was dressed very 90s with like the, yep, the overalls, who was like
baseball cap.
Yeah, who you know, she's like my favorite side character because every time she'd come on it's like, oh, like she just adds like a spark of energy to everything, and it's like you can tell she like took her job as, I guess, PA, I'm not sure, but like started her job very seriously and like was very dedicated to like, you know, having his vision be what it is. And the producer,
yeah,
I really like because he looked ridiculous. Because I think he wore that like gray suit the entire time.
I mean, everybody just say dressed, I mean, except for the, I don't think the wife wore the same thing the whole time, but everybody else wore exactly the same clothes the whole time.
Yeah. What was I going to say? Oh, yeah. So, I noticed with, comparing this to Attacking Woman, Itami might seem to like showing the process of jobs. Because you see, like, the process of movie making in this, of, like, you know, you see the him or he's filming the final scene. You see him like calling out to all the camera units, and he's and the PA girl. She, you know, runs out and gives the hat to like the lead bunk, and like you see like the process of filmmaking, like in the whole intro, it like it's a wrap, and you know then you see like them like break down stuff and. And Attacking Woman, you like it's about the a part of it is the process of what it's like to be a tax inspector.
Yeah. I don't know. What is it? What's the job in Tampopo? Ramen noodle maker?
It's about food. So I'm sure there'll be a lot of cooking.
Oh, you haven't seen it yet?
No, I've only.
So you don't know shit. No, I'm just kidding.
But I did notice like, a theme of like. He likes to show jobs and processes, and you see the operations, and you see like them like going through his guts and stuff.
Right, these are real people with actual jobs, not just like characters.
yeah,
that fit into a spot in the story or something like that. They're not architects, the famous job that people have when you just want to explain that they have a lot of money but not actually ever show them having a job. So what about in comparison to Mara Dio?
One more thing about Last Dance I noticed.
No.
I feel like it may have been partially inspired by Hideo Gosha, who made his last three movies while dying of cancer.
Well, that's fun.
Yeah. I'm going to be writing about that soon-ish. But yeah, the one we did, Heatwave, he made while he was dying of cancer. That was the second to last. And like the whole, when you see the Buhai in this movie trying to direct and like collapsing, and he's not physically up to the task, that was Gosha on Heatwave. And the one he did after that, where this the producer and other people had to really step up and help complete that movie because he was not physically able to do it himself anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole thing at the end with the crew and the doctor and stuff, that made me think of Kenji Fukasaku, who did Battle Royale and Battles with Honor and Humanity and like 90 or ish other movies. He made a shit ton of movies. But at his funeral, like, it was like this giant crowd of people just crying and weeping and like jumping on the casket. Like, people, like, the way the crew absolutely loved Buhai, it reminded me of like what I heard about Fukasaku's funeral, where it was just this massive group of the people he worked with over like the last, I think it's from the 60s, for last like 45 years, who just absolutely loved everything about that man. But Fukasaku died in 2003, so.
Mm.
But still, like, the cult of personality or whatever.
Yeah. So Mara Dio.
You have no other thoughts on Last Dance?
I mean, I want to compare it to the Mara Dio. I don't. What are you trying to squeeze out of me?
Okay, so like the central main thing is an old person who doesn't want to die, and like where like they have different personalities, but they're both about, you know, just trying to stick it out as long as you can.
Kinda, I guess. I mean, like, what I see is we've got a man who has grown this loyalty of like followers and like former students in the case of Mara Dio, like to a fault, like his not to a fault, like they become like an extension, like his actual family. So It's the movie is not only about his life, but also about everyone else's life being affected by what happens to him. And there's like utter sadness when bad things happen to the professor in that movie. You know, even things that feel like it shouldn't be such a big deal, when it's a big deal to the professor, your heartstrings get pulled along with it.
Yeah.
And like we spend years with that character, you know, like, and it feels like we get to know everything about his personality within that time period. And in this case, it's like a man who quickly is coming upon his death, most of the time in denial about it, not prepared to leave the world, but also it's not like a case where he's ever saying, like, I have unfinished work, I can't stop doing that. It's like he can't even imagine not being able to continue his life the way he's been living it. You know, sleeping with who he wants to, working hard all the time, and eating and drinking and smoking and just being that way. So, like, when he is sick and forced to be in the hospital, that's when everything stops for him. And like a lot of this movie is him being miserable because of that, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like the movies have a lot in common, but I feel like their protagonists are opposite sides of the same coin. I don't know what to say, like, you know what,
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, like, you know, one has a very loyal film crew who will do anything for him, and you know, other one has these students who basically become, you know, his family, and you know, there's a whole like a student teacher type thing where it's literal, and the Maradayo, where like, you know, you get a sense of, you know, Buhai and Las Danzas, you know, this mentor, this father figure that all these people are, you know, devoutly loyal to.
Mm-hmm.
And do you interpret the end of Maradayo as he dies?
Part of me does, and another part would also accept that maybe he didn't die that night that we see him, you know?
Yeah.
But I feel like he is, like, close to dying at the very least.
Because...
Yeah, you know, he probably doesn't have much time left, but...
Yeah. I feel like the whole spirit of Maradayo, like the festival thing they did in the film Maradayo, which, if those who don't remember, it means not yet, and it's part of this, like, basically a Japanese version equivalent to a hide and go seek. And I feel like that whole thing of not yet can be applied to Last Dance, where Buhai is, you know, he's like, I can't die, you know, he's like, his mentality is, I can't die yet because I have to live my life.
Yeah, it's interesting that they don't go with the route of him being more like getting away with a bunch of stuff, because there's not a lot of scenes of him like trying to sneak out or secretly drinking or anything like that, because I feel like half of the time we do spend with him before he gets stuck at the hospital, he is just trying to live his normal life after having like that surgery. And it's like, I'm going to keep on going the regular way until he collapses and gets taken back. And like, they realize, oh, okay, this was worse than we even thought back when we thought it was bad. So it's, yeah, it's like, it's hard to explain the way the movie handles everything without actually having somebody watch the movie. Like, it's got a bunch of farce going on, yeah. But
it
doesn't go full blow farce.
Yeah, Tommy's tone is very interesting. Like with Maradayo is like that, like it's easier to I feel like it's easier to explain, where it's like, yeah, it's this episodic movie about the life of this professor and the students who love him, where Last Dance is more like, it's a comedy about someone dying of cancer, but it's not like bad, it's genuinely funny but also sad. Or like, it's like trying to describe the tone of this specifically is challenging to someone who's not used to a Tommy.
Yeah, exactly. But I feel like we kind of handled this the perfect way. I feel like by watching A Taxing Woman, I was better able to like take the swings and tone that this movie had. So, listener, I advise that if you're going to watch The Last Dance, watch A Taxing Woman first, or maybe Tampopo.
Yeah. Don't start with this one. Start with one of the lighter, funnier ones. then get to this.
Mm-hmm. Either way, be prepared.
Yeah.
And same thing with Matadio. Like, we didn't really get into that, but that's like, yeah, that movie triggered you and I in the whole cat sequence thing. Like, it was a different kind of pain, but it was still like, you and I were both like, no, we were upset.
Yeah.
Which I think was funny how Lauren and
Ryan
were like, oh, really?
I saw a stray cat when I was getting gas the other night, and I wanted to rescue it. But I know I can't do that.
Yeah, I don't get the urge to rescue stray cats. And like, if I see a cat who's in trouble, of course I want to help them. But Sarah's got that real bad. Like, if we're driving by and we see one, she'll be like, pull over. What if it needs help? Like, it was going into a yard.
I understand Sarah's a reaction there, because part of me is like, well, I want to make sure it's safe. I want to make sure it's healthy.
I feel less about that way about dogs, which is funny, or less about that about cats than I do about dogs. When I see a dog that's like not on a leash, I want to go and like grab that dog and like put it in my car or something like that. Even if I know the person who's walking next to it is its owner, it's like, you need to have your freaking dog on a leash. If it's not on a leash, it's mine.
Yeah, you leash your dogs. That's important.
They're not people. They're practically, like, if you're going to think of them as a person, think of them as a toddler. A toddler doesn't know not to run into the street. I don't care how well trained it is.
Yeah, as a dog.
Train your toddler.
Well, yeah, they have the mentality of like a 5-year-old, but they can pounce and rip out your neck if they wanted to.
It's always men. You never see women doing that, I feel like.
Yeah, because women are smarter with shit like that.
Smarter with a lot of things.
Well, yeah. But back to Matadio v.
Who cares? No.
They both also show like the process of like what I brought up with Last Dance, the whole thing of it's, you see the process of him making a movie, you see a process of the doctors being doctors and performing surgery. And Matadio, you see the process of him writing, and like he wrote, like Matadio is very autobiographical, but only if you are aware of who the subject is and the history of that specific person. And like you see the process of him writing his essays and stories, and you see the origins of some of his most famous writings with the whole cat sequence, because he wrote a couple books about his cat. And with...
Yeah, I feel like that's more like the origin of the process that's going to happen. Like, when we see him, it's like, oh, he's already had things published, or he's about to have something published, or he was working on something and he was interrupted by his students, or something like this. And this actually shows, like, things going on.
Well, yeah. So it's...
No, it's not like... He wasn't inspired to make a movie about people dying of cancer. His life just happened to coincide with what was happening.
Yeah, but I mean, like, the whole, like, the process of him making a movie, you get to see parts of.
Right, right. What I'm saying is that, like, this is more technical in what their careers are than Matadio is.
Yeah, Matadio is... this might be a little stretch, but I think it's an art film.
I mean, they're both art films, Spencer. Okay. I don't know what to tell you.
I don't think of Last Dance as an art film. I think of it as just like a more standard, not studio film, because Utami made, he was an indie guy, but like, it's not like an art film. It's more. Not that it's artistic, but you know what I'm trying to get at.
Well, they're, to bring up another thing that they have in common, the whole end of life, like, painterly, symbolic sequence that goes on, you know, when there's only a little bit seen in Matadayo when he's having those like very vivid dreams of being a child hiding, and then you see Kurosawa's painting of the sky in the background, right? Yeah. And then in this, you know, we get a very kind of trippy journey through, like, on his way to the afterlife, like clouds of, and people who we can only assume are his relatives. Like you said, he doesn't talk during that sequence, so we don't know. And then there's like a whole kind of Through the Gate to Jupiter 2001 sequence where he's just flying above like mountainous areas and like valleys and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And ends up, you know, flying towards a cliffside where it's just like this symbolic representation of death or the end of life or just even a dream state. Who knows?
Yeah. And Shuzo Itami, he died under mysterious circumstances, December 20th, 1997, and Kurosawa died from, I don't remember where he died from, because he's going blind towards the end of his life. That's why, part of why he stopped making mm-hmm. movies. But he died September 6th of 1998. So they also made these movies about the end of life kind of around the same time. When, well, one was an older man in his 80s who,
yeah,
you know, it's not shocking, but the other one may have been murdered by Yakuza, who it's not clear. But
I mean, this wasn't his last movie. He made three more movies after this. Yeah, he's
kept on making movies, but this is still,
but it could feel like a metaphor for something going on in his life, even so.
Yeah, and this is going back to the Kurosawa died of a stroke. He's 88. Okay. But they mentioned in the movie that the Last Dance that Buhai was in his early 60s, and this, and Gosha was in his early 60s when he died, and Gosha mm-hmm. died 92 after post-production, after finishing post-production of his last movie. I don't think he lived to see it get released, but another element makes you think maybe this one inspired by Gosha a little bit.
Yeah, who knows?
Yeah, there's not much biographical information about Gosha besides a biography written by his daughter that's only Japanese. And there's another biography about him that was written 40 years ago that's only in French. So, nothing I have access to.
So, learn French.
That's a dumb language. I hate it.
Okay.
That's,
so 1993 movies?
93. I guess mine is a controversial pick. According to people I'm friends with on Facebook, it's a terrible movie.
Okay, what is it?
Hocus Pocus, but I only have good memories of it because I watched it a bunch as a kid with my sister. I have not seen it.
Listen. Okay. Listen. The people who say it's a terrible choice and that you have bad taste because of it need to pull a stick out of their ass, okay? Nothing wrong with liking Hocus Pocus, okay? If it doesn't appeal to you as an adult, guess what? You missed your moment. Just like those people that are like, I finally watched Goonies and it was terrible. Like, you missed your moment. That's, you know, I don't know what to tell you. You had to be the right age for something like that. It's... just get off of your stupid thing.
We taped it off a Disney Channel, and we watched that tape a whole lot. I haven't seen it as an adult, but I feel like I probably would like it given how much I watched it as a kid. Yeah. I remember there's a talking cat, I think, and a witch is. Who flies on a vacuum, which was always my favorite part for some reason.
Well, yeah.
But, yeah, so Hocus Pocus. I might give it a rewatch, see if it holds up.
There's a lot of garbage that came out in 93 that I happen to have watched, and I'd rather talk about, honestly, some of that stuff. For instance, the movie Super Mario Brothers came out in 1993. Have you seen Super Mario Brothers?
I tried to watch it once when I was, I think, 11. It was on Disney Channel at midnight. And I was like, I'm going to watch this, but I kind of fell asleep because it was midnight and I was tired. So I have no memory of it.
I was 12 when it came out. I feel like if I had seen it when I was younger, I would have had nightmares because there's just some gross stuff going on in it. Wayne's World 2 came out that year. That's a disappointing sequel.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not the worst movie, but no good.
Mike Myers had another movie that year, too. So I Married an Axe Murderer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so he was trying different things. Yeah,
I haven't seen Axe Murder in a while. I remember liking it in high school, but...
Yeah, that's where he invented his Shrek character.
Is it?
Well, he plays a grandfather who's, like, doing his Scottish accent. Just kidding. Can you find a movie where he doesn't do a Scottish accent? I don't think you can. Anyway... a good movie that I would like to talk about that came out in 1993. Let's see. Doppelganger? No, not Doppelganger.
Doppelganger is a good movie.
Doppelganger Gate?
Yes.
If you want to hear what I think about Doppelganger, go back into the Please Don't Send Me into Outer Space archive and look for that episode.
I think episode 10 or 11.
It's pretty early on, and it was... It was a shock, let me tell you.
Yeah, that ending, oh boy, they really set the ending properly, don't they?
Yeah, I mean it is literally telegraphed in the very beginning, but that's it. But otherwise, no. Things came out. Jurassic Park, great movie. I still love it. I still watch it once every year. Schindler's List, I watched that once and I thought it was amazing, and I don't watch it again because I don't usually rewatch depressing movies. Batman Mask of the Phantasm, like, that's, you don't get much better when it comes to, like, animated superhero movies, and it's probably one of the best Batman movies that has been made. Have you seen that one?
No. I saw the one where it's like him fighting Mr. Freeze. That was a direct-to-video.
Oh yeah, it's like Heart of Ice or something like that. Yeah.
It came a couple years later. I remember watching that sleepover.
That one's also pretty dang good. Now, they had something real special with that original animated series.
Yeah, I
like a level of darkness that was super fascinating to a kid, but it still wasn't too, like, I don't know. There were some episodes that I found upsetting, but not like in a I can never watch this again sort of way.
Yeah, I was more of a Batman Beyond kid because that was. That premiered around the perfect age for me to see it.
You're all like, Terry, whatever his name is, he's my hero.
Yeah, I mainly remember the Bane episode where it was like, it's a new drug that the kids are taking that's a skin patch that makes you super strong.
Whoa. Give me some of that.
Yeah, Batman Beyond was pretty good.
That's what I've heard. I think... If I had to pick a favorite movie from 93 that wasn't one of the ones that we covered, I got to go with Tombstone. I don't know if that's like a stereotypical guy movie. Sometimes I feel like some of the things I liked in the 90s were. But like there is such a prestige of actors in that, like Bill Paxton and Val Kilmer and Kurt Russell and Sam Elliott, you know, playing these kind of notorious like lawmen at that time, and it's just done in such a way like the bad guys are bad, the good guys are not incorruptible. That's the word I'm trying to say, but they are. I don't know. It feels prestige to me. It feels special, and. Like, it has very cheesy parts in it. Like, any movie with Jason Priestley has a cheesy part in it. Don't, you know, that's just a fact. You got like freaking Michael Biehn. You got Powers Booth, Charlton Heston in a smaller role.
Got Billy Bob.
Yeah. Oh, see, I forget about that because he's like a fat guy in that movie. It's pretty.
Oh, he wasn't. Oh, there's a time where he wasn't like super skinny.
No. Hmm. Oh yeah, Billy Zane. Jeez, Michael Roker. Okay.
Delaware's Robert Mitchum. Went to high school in Delaware. He counts.
Anyways, I just, like, I love it.
Oh, John Corbett.
Most of the more modern Westerns.
And Paul Benvictor from, I believe it was On a Wire.
There you go.
I believe one of the Greek people on a wire.
A Greek person on the wire?
He was season 2 where they got the Greek mafia or whatever. That season.
I just remember that. There's something going down in the shipping things.
Yeah, that was like all the Greek people.
Oh, okay.
And well, Greek mafia or whatever thing. I need to rewatch The Wire. But
me too.
My other one is True Romance, which was the
Tony Scott.
Tarantino wrote the script by, I think, it's the same year as Reservoir Dogs, maybe the year after.
That he wrote the script? I mean, Reservoir Dogs is not 93. Because Pulp Fiction is 92.
Pulp Fiction is 94.
Oh, okay.
Reservoir Dogs was first. But yeah, True Romance was... Dogs is 92, then 93 is True Romance. But True Romance was a script... I think it was supposed to be like the first one he wrote... with his former writing partner, Lawrence Bender, I think was his name. But
Olivier.
But they aren't friends anymore.
Of course not.
And, Natural Born Killers and True Romance were originally just one mega script that they realized this will never work, so they split up into separate movies. One turned out to be I think a really good, really fun Tony Scott movie with Christian Slater and Patricia Arquette and James Gandolfini. You get the Dennis Hopper. You get Christopher Walken. The cast of
cameo from Sonny Chiba.
What are you talking about?
They're watching Street Fighter.
I know that, but you don't see. Do you see him? Do you see clips of Street Fighter?
I can't remember. I only watched that movie once, and I disliked it, so...
Oh, well, you don't know fun. And most importantly, you get an early role of Mr. Gary Oldman playing a pimp. And probably one my favorite Gary Oldman role.
Yeah, that scumbag Gary Oldman playing another amazing role.
Yeah, I believe it was called Drexel Spider, I think.
Yeah, he's got dreadlocks, that's all I know.
Yeah, Samuel Jackson. Too many people in the name. And yeah, the other Tarantino script from around this time was
From Dust Till Dawn?
Born Killers, which is, I don't think, is a good movie.
I haven't even bothered to watch it because I am not really an Oliver Stone fan when it comes to his movies.
I like Platoon
I'm a fan of Oliver Stone.
Well, I like Platoon a lot. And then I saw Natural Born and I was like, Platoon's way better than this shit.
I like Wall Street. I've seen Platoon, and I didn't like it. But, that's about it.
Yeah. I guess technically Scarface counts, because he wrote the script for Scarface.
Who?
Oliver Stone. But Scarface isn't a good movie, in my opinion.
Oh, who directed Scarface?
De Palma.
Oh, okay. Okay. I like De Palma.
The Palma's hit or miss for me.
Yeah, but when he misses big time.
Oh, yeah. Once a miss, it does not work. That's all. The next pairing is 1985, which will be Ran with Benjamin Sunday, and Tampopo with return guest Martin Kessler.
Ran?
Yeah.
Which adaptation is that?
That's King Lear.
Okay. I don't know anything about King Lear.
Yeah, but apparently it is a legit, like, it's not, like, vaguely inspired. It's actually, like, Kurosawa taking King Lear, and it's closer to Throne of Blood.
I see. The other movie I haven't seen.
Yeah. Which we will get to in a couple months.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, yeah, that, don't you send people into space, like, don't you send launch there into space against her will?
All the time, whether she likes it or not, into space. So if you want to hear me talk about science fiction and fantasy movies, I have another podcast called Please Don't Send Me Into Outer Space, which I do with my hosts, co-hosts Aaron and Sarah. And yeah, I basically laid it out. We talk about science fiction and fantasy. Most recently, we released an episode on the amazing movie LXG:League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Psh, what? It's me, Sean Connery. No, anyways, that movie sucks, but we had a lot of fun talking about it and nerding out about certain aspects of the comic books. And before that, we had one more movie in our summertime special, which is we usually take a month off to talk about non-science fiction and fantasy movies. And Sarah introduced us to this amazing, amazing movie called Stone Cold, starring Brian Bosworth, which is on full on YouTube. Like, you know what? Don't bother watching The Last Dance. Go watch Stone Cold instead. You'll thank me later.
Okay.
Or you could just listen to our podcast about that. But all those episodes are available in the usual places, iTunes, Stitcher Radio, blah, 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 blah.
So I understand you and Sarah have recovered since the Stone Cold incident?
Oh, we're in counseling.
Okay. It's a traumatic episode for Joel and Sarah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you could tell. It extends into the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen episode. Like, it's an ongoing thing here.
Yeah. For me, I did an episode of Flixwise Canada on David and Lisa, a very interesting romance about two mentally ill teenagers, and I don't know when it's coming out. Still not really sure, but it'll come out in the future at some point. I did that. I was on Russo Files Unite talking about Ivan's childhood. That comes out in January. So, if you're listening to this right now, you're probably going to forget it's going to happen in January. But regardless, yeah, I'll be on season 3. I think that's the third season he's doing. I can't remember. So, there's that. There is continuing my series at Jailhouse 701 Japanese Cult Cinema on Hideo Gosha, called Hideo Gosha, The Line Between Sleaze and Prestige. Next one will be part 3, the 1980s, which will be a not a happy thing to research, because that was not a good period for him initially. And then part 4 will be his death, because he died in 92. So there won't. So yeah, the closing up on this series is not happy, but you know, not everything is happy. But if you aren't familiar with Hideo Gosha, go watch his stuff. It's on Filmstruck. I think one of his movies, Hunter in the Dark, is on Amazon Prime. He's worth checking out. He deserves more attention than what he gets.
Hunter in the Dark was on Filmstruck. Is it not there anymore?
It is, but. Not everyone has Filmstruck.
Oh, you mean not everybody has Filmstruck, yeah. That's true.
And you can buy some DVDs of his stuff. Some is just not available in this part of the world easily. But a good chunk of it is. Netflix DVD has a pretty good amount of stuff. But yeah, you know, seek out Gosha's work. It definitely is worth watching if you like things that are prestigious. Yet there's a little taste of sleaze thrown in there. And he uses Nakadai a lot, so of course, I love his work. But there's that, and yeah, that's it. So, hashtag ThugLife, Nakadai forever, Itami forever.
Hashtag be nice to your wife, please. You might die of cancer suddenly. Bye.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. The show's Twitter is @highandlowpod. The show can be found on Facebook under the title of High and Low, a Kurosawa podcast. The show is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Podbean. We are no longer on Podiant. Thank you for listening. RZA, let's defraud the hope. When the motherfucker steps out his place and gets slapped in his goddamn face, just because the nigga what he tried to base. But G.O.D. But G.O.D. And while I see his whole clique passes by, motherfuckers think they qualify. And for those niggas want to try, the G.O.D., the G.O.D. We were on the same ship when the slaves were checked. I had to put your card, you was on the top deck, so I plotted my escape. I saw the thin line between love and hate.